Today is Wednesday. Yes, it's Wednesday. It is November 27th, 2019. It's 11:07 in the morning. Happy anniversary, Brenda. I'm John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record weekly at the studios of WGN Radio in Chicago. Listen for me weekdays, now at an all-new time, from 9 a.m. until 12 noon.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute and co-author of The New Chicago Way. Happy anniversary, Brenda.
I'm Heather Sharon of The Daily Line, Managing Editor and City Hall Reporter.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I am a writer at the Chicago Tribune, and I put together the Spin Politics newsletter every afternoon.
She seems like she's lying about it, doesn't she?
She's been covering the budget. We've lost all sense of time and space and everything.
Reality. See, Bertrand can't join us today.
I'm sitting in his chair, though, John.
I know. That's why when I normally turn and let Steve start it, but then I wanted to save the juice from Eric for last. So thank you all for being here. Heather, start us off with the mayor's budget. And what does it mean for me and my pocketbook or me and my life? Is the world in Chicago going to change much as a result of this?
Well, you won't pay a significant amount more property taxes if you live in the city. You will, however, be able to go to the libraries on Sunday afternoon, eventually, because there is a small property tax hike to allow that to happen, reversing a cut put in place in 2011. However, if you plan on hopping into an Uber or a Lyft downtown or to get to downtown, it's going to cost you triple in taxes. And Mayor Lori Lightfoot says that will generate about $40 million and hopefully reduce congestion downtown.
So she didn't go with Lyft's or Uber's suggestion that they tax taxis as well and tax Uber less.
She did not. And yesterday, after the budget was approved, she basically invited Uber and Lyft to sue the city, noting that she has 30 years of litigation experience and that if they saw fit to bring it.
You know, I never thought of her as a lightweight. I mean, maybe the first time I saw her, I did, because she's a lightweight. But I always thought she's got a spine and she's bright. But I've not exactly understood the depth of animosity she has with this company.
It's a real change, because that was not how Rahm Emanuel pushed through taxes on businesses. You know, he also raised taxes on ride-hailing services. It was a significantly smaller hike, but it was still a hike. And the firms went along with it because he had sort of all worked it out behind the scenes. This was a very public fight where she cast them as evil and the city as their victim, essentially.
I don't care who's evil. I mean, I don't have a dog in this hunt. My ego isn't on the line, but doesn't it seem to you, Lisa, like Lori's ego is on the line here?
Look, I think that Uber, they have some deep pockets to put these lobbyists to work and to, you know, contribute to campaigns and everything else. They have muscle, not just here, but across the country, across the world, really, although not in London, apparently. Which just canceled the contract there. But I think that she felt she was pushing against a bit of a Goliath here, and that Rahm had not pushed them and not maximized funds, because his brother was past tense, an early investor. And there was it was seen as a conflict. They just got to sort of to go wherever they want. There wasn't any kind of strict licensing in place. And they certainly weren't held to the sort of same standards that the cab companies were. That slowly caught up, but it's not there's not parity.
So if I go from a neighborhood to downtown, it's going to be $3.
If you're by yourself,
right.
If you catch a shared ride, you're not going to pay that much more.
Yeah. And if you go from a neighborhood to a neighborhood in a shared ride, you're going to pay a little bit less.
Right.
Now, what was your sense, Heather? Why did the mayor, she was so dismissive of Uber's counterproposal? I mean, they had various zones, and they said they were going to be able to raise more money their way than her way. She just gave it the back of her hand.
My sense is that she felt that it didn't address congestion in the way that her plan did, and congestion downtown. That was really sort of her, we're doing this for the money, sure, but that's the societal good we're trying to get to here. And I don't think she felt like the counterproposal addressed that.
Now, one thing that really struck me in all these stories about the budget was a remark that the mayor made after she, you know, won this vote. People were asking her about some of the one-time sources of revenue, the way she was claiming. She was like clawing all this money into her current budget, so she's not going to have it. And she said something to the effect, well, the out years will take care of themselves. And that seemed to me to be very glib.
That's business. That's how it's been for the last 15 years in Chicago. It's a huge can.
Yes, and it's a very distressingly cavalier about the future that we're facing, and the fact that she, as a lot of people have argued, this budget is a lot of smoke and mirrors and hopes, and a lot of things that she was hoping for down in Springfield, she got none of them, and the idea that there's something sustainable or even you know, portentous about this in a good way. Auspicious, I meant to say, is foolish. This is this she just barely staggered across the finish line here, and then she went and smoked a victory cigar. I don't know.
Well, her out year plans relies basically on two things that she didn't get yet in Springfield. One, a change in the way the Chicago casino would be structured to attract an operator and investors. Is that going to go through after they reconvene after the first of the year? I don't know.
What would make you think that it would? What would make anyone think that it would? They had plenty of opportunity.
So the state's vertical capital plan, so that $45 billion plan, relies in part on revenue from a Chicago casino. So if the Chicago casino never gets off the ground, the state's going to have to figure out how to pay for that capital plan. And that's an even harder question than how do we change the Chicago plan.
But Chicago will get a casino, right? It has to get a casino.
I think there's a huge question
about it. And that's going to be the linchpin, is getting that casino, that funding formula, rebooted, because everybody gets to take that back to their hometown. Hey, look, these roads are better. Hey, it's a bipartisan thing. It isn't in anybody's interest not to see this
casino
thing go through,
revenue.
But you also have these towns saying, all right, Chicago's going to drain some of our casino revenues away, excuse me. And I just don't know. I feel like it's a 50-50.
But beyond Uber, beyond the casino, beyond the real estate transfer tax, there's still just made up savings items in this budget. There's stuff like we just say zero-based budgeting and magically we get tens of millions of dollars in savings.
Which is where every line item starts from zero, right?
Right, which in theory is a great thing, but there's no independent analysis of any of the claims that they are making on this budget. And right. So I met with the new city council, it's called COFA, the Office of Financial Analysis, and the whole point of COFA is to say for years and years the mayor just makes up budget numbers and then the next mayor comes in and, oh wait, the whole is, you know, twice as big as we thought. So we need some independent analysts in there. COFA could fit in a broom closet. It's two guys. One of them, it was his first day. It's like, it's the whose line is it anyway of budgeting where the math is made up and the numbers don't matter. And we're going to be in this exact same place next year. That's what's so frustrating about that cigar remark, because it's so flippant. And I think it's going to come back to haunt her next year when it's a huge crisis and we're going to be back where we started. Well,
she has to take care of the out years.
Yes.
She's got three more years, right? The out years don't take care of themselves. Lori
right.
Lightfoot, 1 year from now, takes care of
it. She's also sort of, her and her team are thinking politically too, obviously. I mean, this is somebody who's coming off of an 11-day teacher strike, and then she's wrapping up this budget where she doesn't have to hike taxes. She doesn't want these year in review or, you know, first 6 months in review stories to say she had to hike property taxes and the teacher struck. Sounds like Rahm Emanuel.
But isn't the lesson of politics that you do these kind of things early in your 4-year term rather than, because if she's got to put off a property tax hike and has to do it in a year or 2 years, it's closer and closer to her presumptive reelection bid.
You have to have a 5-year plan. Success would look like, here's how we're going to get out of it in 5 years.
Really?
This isn't success because she's going to be, all these same questions are going to arise again.
Well, the Illinois Policy Institute said that none of this matters without pension reform. I mean, you said it's impossible was the word that you guys had on your site, and I don't suppose there's any disagreement here. And the idea is this where we are on pension reform, that those pensions are, we're going to have to live with them as long as the recipients are alive, but the next sets of pensions need to be less generous, right?
Well, we've already done that with Tier 2. It doesn't solve the actual problem. So what's funny is, I think about 3 weeks ago, there was a huge conference at University of Chicago, and there are all these economists there talking about the pension crisis. How do we solve the pension crisis? All of them universally said, you got to reduce the actual liability. You can't do tweaks around the edges. You have to actually reduce the promises that have been made
to people who are currently receiving them.
Exactly.
And you can do that?
You need a constitutional amendment, but the math doesn't work in paying it off with tax hikes without that. And all these economists agree on that. And I think if the same thing was being said by climate scientists, we would call people who deny their findings climate change deniers.
And
we should call the same thing.
We're doing as much about climate change as we are the pension crisis. I mean, so all of this, Anna, I sense a lot of hostility at Lori Lightfoot these days, and I'm thinking, what's a mayor to do? Maybe she could manage these things on the edges better. But seriously, if she did all of that, wouldn't we still be in a hole that's intractable?
You have to give people hope, and you have to give people a plan that they can believe in. This thing where we go year to year trying to fill holes that magically appear won't work. And I think that's the way you have to do. You have to be honest, and you have to have a plan.
What is the politics, the political strategy advanced by people who say that we can do pension reform or changes? If you're going to change the pension system, how do you do it politically?
Democrats have to get on board, which is what happened in 2011 and 2013. So Democratic supermajorities and a Democratic governor signed all this stuff.
And to do that, you have to get unions on board, right? Because of union support.
And in every state where reforms have worked, it has usually been with some kind of buy-in from some union support.
So describe for me the pension recipient and how their life would change if all of this happens.
Our plan addresses the 3% compounding raise every year. So that's what would change. It would be tied to inflation.
So say I'm getting a check for a couple thousand dollars a month as my pension, and each year it goes up $300, would be $600. It would stay at $2,000. It would not go up each month.
But the increase would, you would get an increase that's actually tied to inflation, and you may need some catch-up years where it's frozen as well.
The 3%, that wasn't cost of living?
That's the built-in increase. That's what we're trying to reduce. So instead of getting a $600 increase, maybe you'd get a $300 increase some years.
Am I right that when they instituted the 3% increase, they thought it was a good deal because inflation was running higher than that?
Yes.
And so the cost of living, they said, 3%, this is great. We're limiting them to 3% a year as opposed to maybe 4 or 5% if we tied it to inflation.
The problem is it's been way more inflation, more than inflation for the last 25 years. So it was a terrible decision.
And I love that you are the sort of person that goes and finds the KOFU people. Is that what they're called?
KOFA. They're good people. Yeah.
This is the third largest city in America. And these are the people, the only people pretty much outside the mayor's office who have the ability to do independent analysis on this stuff.
How independent are they? Who hires them?
So they're hired by Pat Dowell, who's the chair of the budget committee, and she's in charge of sort of operating all that. And are they independent? Well, Pat Dowell has her position because Lori Lightfoot said she could have that position. So that's how Chicago works.
Do they serve at
position? They serve at the pleasure of all. Any alderman can go to them and ask a question.
Yes.
About but I'm saying, can Pat Dowell say, I don't like this. Your forecast is too gloomy for my taste.
Sure. Right. With the tail wag the dog, in other words, here's what we need. Now you get the numbers that make that happen.
Inspector generals and things like that often have sort of independent terms.
Right. But this is not that independent.
Okay. Speaking of money, can you explain to me the pension that John Cullerton is potentially going to get?
This is the sexiest podcast we've ever had.
Trust me, if you're still listening, you'll be glad. You will be glad you are here.
Johnson's shock jock.
The problem with pensions is the ones that people care about the most aren't the massive numbers because it's unfathomable. People don't understand how big they are. But when a politician gets one, people freak out and they're like, well, we could just fix the pension problem if we just stop giving all these politicians pensions. And it's like, yeah, it's a drop in the bucket. So John Cullerton announced that the Senate president, second longest serving lawmaker in Springfield behind Mike Madigan, announced that he's going to retire in January of next year. So, of course, when people retire in Illinois, they get a pension. And John Cullerton will receive a pension that's about 85% of his final salary. So he's going to be in around the $85,000 range. What's interesting is, instead of getting a 3% bump in the next year, he's going to get a 54% bump in his pension. And it's because of this very obscure pension sweetener law that was passed in basically a day in 1989 that allows lawmakers for years to bank COLAs. So veteran lawmakers who have been in Springfield for a long time, Barbara Flynn Curry was one of them, Lou Lang was one of them, when he retired, they all get this huge sweetener. And over the course of his retirement, he's going to receive more than $2 million in pension benefits because of that sweetener that he helped to pass.
Just $2 million extra dollars because of this sweetener?
$2 million total. So the extra because of the sweetener, I would say probably, it's a 54% increase, then it goes up a lot every year. So it's a substantial part of that. It's going to be the six-figure pension he gets because of sweetener.
I don't understand what you said.
So he starts at $85,000, and anyone else who starts an $85,000 pension gets a little 3% bump every year, right?
Right.
Because Cullerton has had these years of service where he's banked 3% COLAs.
How did you bank something that you're not getting?
You bank it for later. So
yeah, but you're not receiving a pension in those years that you were in service anyway, right?
Correct. No, you're saying for every extra year of service, it's this special sweetener that says John Cullerton, in your second year of retirement, you're going to get 3% boosts for every additional year you've served in the legislature. It's very weird.
But it wasn't an active decision on his part every year to turn something down.
No, it's automatic.
So you say banking it, you just mean that this is...
He's accruing these boosts.
He's accruing it, but he's not... It's not something he didn't take. It just this happened. It's a passive.
I thought he was not saving, not receiving some money along the way.
No, yeah, sorry. He's not rejecting anything. Exactly. It's just for every year of service, he's getting an extra benefit. So instead of an $85,000 pension going to an $86,000 pension, the next year it's going to go to an $120,000 pension in one year.
And every year, but this is in 1 year. That's the one time it goes up like that.
Exactly. And then it'll go 3%.
I resent you calling it a little 3%. 3% is fine. That's plenty.
Yes, I would take that.
I don't know why they felt like...
Lisa and I work for the Tribune, remember?
Yeah. You want to share any thoughts about that, Eric?
I don't think I have any printable thoughts about what's been going on there. Yeah. We can talk about that. I'm not averse to talking about it, but I do want to circle back to this special deal. If you can... This was just like happened in one day and nobody reported on it.
It was part of a huge kind of huge pension chain. So Emil Jones, was a part of it. And this is when Cullerton was in the House. So he's actually on a committee that was hearing this. And
play devil's advocate for me and explain how this was presented to the lawmakers as a good thing.
I mean
other than just self-interest.
It's hard to say. So like one of the reasons might be, well, we want to encourage, people who have stayed in the legislature this long. They actually have a lower salary they can get than they could get in the private sector. So we want to make sure that they're rewarded in retirement for all of their great service to the people of Illinois.
Please, really.
Where were we at this? What were we thinking?
Right.
Now, is this the? I have to say, I haven't seen this. Is this on your site?
No,
Austin?
This is secret Mincing Rascals information. I'm going to publish a story probably today or tomorrow because I just got the FOIA response back.
Back to the office. Let's go.
So, if I wanted to read more about this, where would I go?
IllinoisPolicy.org.
IllinoisPolicy.org. But can I tell you guys something that lit up my phone lines this weekend? It was something that Eric Zorin sent me, and that was the hot food takes that somebody put out as a Twitter thread. Did you follow up on that?
I just sent you the link saying, John, this is blowing up on Twitter. You should do something on the radio about it.
Miami of Ohio University student said, retweet this with your, most controversial comment on food. And so people said Chinese food sucks or Indian food I don't like or...
Lettuce, we're all eating lettuce and nobody really likes it.
And has the courage to stop. There were bad things said about Brussels sprouts, which I completely endorse. So, that's the beauty of Twitter, right? And it really took off and it went viral. But it's also the bane of Twitter because when one guy said, nobody will admit that Chinese food is just salty glop and it's terrible... And then that man was judged to be racist. And the guy who said bad things about Indian food, boy, there's a lesson learned for us all now. He just said, I don't like the food.
So here's the difference. If he had said, I don't like dal or I don't like curry, that's sort of a specific food as opposed to an entire group of ethnic food. So saying I don't like lettuce is, I think, fundamentally different than saying I don't like Indian food.
I get that point. Do you really believe that? Do you really mean that?
I do. I mean, so I went to high school with two friends, one of whom was Pakistani and one of whom was Indian, and they traditionally brought, food their parents made for lunch. And the amount of abuse and bullying they took in the high school lunchroom, I shudder to think about it. So they were consistently having to defend, no, it's just lamb. No, it's just spices. No, it's just rice, And they begged their parents, let me take a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, please. And they wouldn't because their parents felt insulted. So this is just a deep, deep sore spot for so many people. And if you don't like a specific kind of food, which was what that tweet was asking, because you could have responded, I don't like lettuce, just like Eric said, but to sort of say, I don't like this entire ethnic group, I think just sort of pounded into that sore spot that really my friends struggle with, to this day. They were made to feel different and un-American, and it had a real impact on their lives. And I winced when I saw that.
Who doesn't like naan? He can't just,
For the record, I was quoting the guy about lettuce. I think lettuce is fine.
Eric wants everybody to know he is fine with lettuce.
I'm fine with lettuce. But, Heather makes point about you know, this sort of blanket prejudice against certain kinds of ethnic food. I say that one of the things that I feel like is a part of maturing as a person is that you learn that, yeah, there are certain kinds of ethnic foods that you may not like most of them, but there's always something like naan in these cuisines that you can get to.
And it is ridiculous to generalize. There are regions of India that the food is different. I mean, it does. It sort of reveals some kind of prejudice.
I have a hot food take about a Chicago institution. I'm wondering whether I should say it or not.
I'm going to move away from you in case you are.
It's a smoked fish place that I go to every year.
Hagen's?
On the south side?
Maybe. It's not the best. Everyone says, everyone thinks it's the best. I'll tell you guys off air. I bet the listeners maybe could figure out what I'm talking about.
This is the damn weirdest conversation we have ever had. On social media, the petition was, give me a controversial food take. And a guy had the temerity to say, I don't like Indian food. And we have all not given him the space to say that. I don't think we know anything about this person other than he doesn't like the food at Indian restaurants. I'm sure those pains were real, but this guy doesn't have anything to do with that, right, Heather?
But I think it's emblematic of how easy it can be to say, I don't like that whole group of people. Mm-hmm. So certainly he didn't say that.
He didn't say that, and you don't know that he meant that.
Sure,
you don't
know anything about this guy. Sure he didn't.
I'll bet he doesn't.
Yeah, and I'm sure he didn't. If my kid throws a ball across the room and whaps her sister in the face and she gets a black eye, I'm not saying that that recently happened in my life. I'm just making that up out of whole cloth. If my oldest says, I was just having fun, I didn't mean to give her a black eye, it doesn't mean that she doesn't have to say, I'm sorry.
Do you think this guy should repost, I'm sorry that I offended?
I don't know that that's a meaningful sort of, you know, addition. I would hope that he heard that he caused people pain completely inadvertently.
Great. And of course, on Twitter, it doesn't encourage any kind of nuance. I mean, there are a certain time people will say, hey, let's go to a Greek restaurant. And I'll say, you know, I don't like Greek restaurants that well, but I don't mean anything bad about the Greek people. You know, it's like I know.
How do we know that? How do we know that?
You hate Spanakopita? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I mean seriously.
Just like John Cass gives me the hairy eyeball in the office. Like, now just figured this out.
I don't know what the takeaway here is because I'm just curious about if this is a lesson learned for people about public speech.
The whole thing was sort of ridiculous, and there were a bunch of takeoffs on it. And you realize, and somebody was commenting on this too, you realize that Twitter is just one big space to get attention. You put yourself on that thread so you can shine the spotlight on yourself, good, bad, or indifferent, without nuance, without any kind of reflection. Let's just join in and see if I can get some new followers and a bunch of likes.
We have reached a weird place if I can't say I don't like Indian food.
You're certainly going to be part of a conversation. Nobody's saying you can't say it.
No, really, this is a learning moment for me. Do you all agree with that? That it's actually not... We're in a place right now where that's not a real safe or smart statement.
I would say that I had never considered this point until even this conversation. I had not considered that point about it being offending someone like that. So I need to think about this a little bit more because my reaction is more like Lisa's, which is kind of like, what? John, did you have a hot food take that you shared?
I still want you to tell us.
I'm not saying it on the
Why
air.
Why are you so afraid
I like
to
this
say that?
Place.
Oh, because you don't want to hurt them.
Yes.
Okay, that's a different motive and a legitimate one, but that's fine. That's fine.
You can find Austin at...
I think people that eat Brussels sprouts and champion Brussels sprouts don't like them. They're bragging. They know it's a healthy food. It stinks up the room. It can't have a good flavor. Nobody likes Brussels sprouts as much as Brussels sprouts advocates seem to. I don't know what the takeaway here is because I'm just curious about if this is a lesson learned for people about public speech.
I think the whole thing was sort of ridiculous, and there were a bunch of takeoffs on it. And you realize, and somebody was commenting on this too, you realize that Twitter is just one big space to get attention. You put yourself on that thread so you can shine the spotlight on yourself, good, bad, or indifferent, without nuance, without any kind of reflection. Let's just join in and see if I can get some new followers and a bunch of likes.
But when you think of what the politicians are saying, or athletes, you know, what is being lobbed at us in the popular culture, we have reached a weird place if I can't say I don't like Indian food.
I don't think anybody's saying you can't say it, but You're certainly going to be part of a conversation. Nobody's saying you can't say it.
No, really, this is a learning moment for me. Do you all agree with that? That it's actually not... We're in a place right now where that's not a real safe or smart statement.
I would say that I had never considered this point until even this conversation. I had not considered that point about it being offending someone like that. So I need to think about this a little bit more because my reaction is more like Lisa's, which is kind of like, what?
Well, I would say that it's also, we use different speech in different settings, right? So you saying to your friends, I don't like Greek food, I don't want to go to a Greek restaurant, in a group of six people is one thing. If you were to put on Twitter, I hate Greek food, and you have several tens of thousands of followers, it's a different context. So I will use language in my personal life that I would not use on this podcast. And I don't see that as any different because I think about how, you know, what I'm trying to communicate and to whom I am trying to communicate it.
And I also think way back in my life, I was a food writer. And one of the things that always struck me is that I learned so much about a culture, a certain culture, from writing about their food and the pride that's there.
Yes.
I think you really have to think about, I feel like this is being passed off here as some kind of like PC statement. Oh, you can't make those remarks. No, you have to think about where other people are at in the world. And especially right now, when there does seem to be sort of, people are able to sort of exhibit this sort of, you know, racism and classism and everything else. I think being careful, it's not a bad thing to think about other people's feelings. Certainly, you can say what you want. People are saying whatever they feel, whatever they want, but expect the pushback.
Free speech is not consequence-free speech.
Right.
I'm always fascinated by how language evolves anyway, right? And so if I can think of a number of words or expressions that 2 years ago or 20 years ago were okay, were in fact acceptable, and now we've said, you know what, we don't put it that way anymore. I hesitate to even bring up any examples, but I'll bring up just one because I heard it the other day, the word retarded, which has a whole host of legitimate uses. Things can be retarded, but to describe a person that way, we don't do it anymore. And X number of years ago, that was not such a... You did not have to apologize for using that at a public space. Now, pretty much nobody does that unless they suffer the consequences. I'm done with this topic, and Heather, I heard every word you said, but I'm not ready to put I don't like Indian food in that box, but it's an evolutionary thing, Eric. We're going to have to learn to listen and think about
this. Let's do a weekly update on this. So, John, John, did you have a hot food take that you shared?
I still want you to tell us.
I'm not saying it on the air.
Why are you so afraid to say
that? Because I like this place.
Because you don't want to hurt them.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a different motive and a legitimate one, but that's fine. That's fine.
You can find Austin at...
I think people that eat Brussels sprouts and champion Brussels sprouts don't like them. They're bragging. They know it's a healthy food. It stinks up the room. It can't have a good flavor. Nobody likes Brussels sprouts as much as Brussels sprouts advocates seem to.
So that's interesting because one of the things I'm looking most forward to eating on Thanksgiving
is Brussels sprouts.
Yes. My husband makes a fantastic Brussels sprouts. However, I will admit, it's about 90% butter.
Right. I was going to say, I make my in bacon. I think you'd change your mind if you had. Yeah.
Maybe so.
Yeah. You just don't like people from Brussels. That's
yeah.
The issue.
Yeah.
You know, I'm reading this thing that Peter, is it Buttigieg or Buttigieg?
Buttigieg.
Buttigieg had to put up with. I just want to read you the quote that he made when he was running for mayor in 2011. He's running for mayor in 2011. How old does that make him? That was 8 years ago. He's 30.
So he'd be 30 or 31.
He was talking about why some kids fail at school, minority students. And he said this, kids need to see evidence that education is going to work for them. Hold on.
Wait till John finds the quote.
I've got the quote here.
Yeah, can you read it to us?
You're motivated because you believe that at the end of your educational process, there's a reward, there's a stable life, there's a job, and there are a lot of kids, especially the lower income minority neighborhoods, who literally just haven't seen it work. There isn't anybody they know personally who testifies to the value of education. And I think it's that last.
Read that again.
The quote is, you're motivated because you believe at the end of your educational process, there's a reward, there's a stable life, there's a job, and there are a lot of kids, especially the lower income minority neighborhoods, who literally just haven't seen it work. There isn't somebody they know personally who testifies to the value of education, Buttigieg said. Is the that word, was 2010.
This blew up on Twitter this week.
Is the word testified the problem there? I mean, there's... My reading of the critique of this was that it was is far too it reveals a shallow understanding of the problems that African American children face in schools and underfunded schools and in jobless neighborhoods and so on. But it seems like what he said is not false. It's just not complete enough.
We're talking nuance here.
Yeah,
we're not
I think it's the personally
that,
part.
Yeah, I think. Too that he is not reflecting sort of there, just as there are sort of various classes and of white people, different experiences that happens in the African American, Latino community, and this sort of made it look like all African Americans are low income and not seeing anybody seeing anybody who's in that position of being well-educated and going on to have good careers.
So I think the problem with it is that it frames the issue as a lack of ability or interest as opposed to a lack of resources and opportunity. And I think that it's very, sort of hurtful to suggest that a group of people, an ethnic group of people, however you want to break it down, are suffering because of some intrinsic quality to them, as opposed to the systemic structural opposition and obstacles that they face.
Well, I think that's getting to the reason that Michael Harriet and The Root, this is where it's originally surfaced, is calling him a lying MF, and he spells it out.
Twitter is great, isn't it?
Many times. He just blistered him in the story and on social media, and his point was not that that's not true, but that Mayor Pete knows that it's not true, that it's not a lack of example, but it's that there's not that it is systemic. And white people get blinded by the light of their virtue and they don't see the truth of it, says him. And then the point that I was getting from him is not that some people of privilege or white people are ignorant to this. Mayor Pete knows that's not why kids in the hood aren't doing better, but he's lying about it. And he didn't identify the motivation, and Mayor Pete, when he called him back, didn't cop to it completely.
I don't think he should. I mean, so Illinois is a good example of this. So Illinois has one of the most highly educated black workforces in the country in terms of higher education attainment, number of people with bachelor's and above. One of the worst employment outcomes for black Illinoisans among black residents of other states. So if, I don't think that it actually, impugns the intelligence of a community if they see that the returns to education are not there. That's not an investment of time and energy that they're going to make. That's how that reads to me.
Talk about safe statements. When Mayor Pete simply said running for mayor 8 years ago, I think there's not enough positive role modeling for some of the kids to see the fruits of education. I didn't think that was something that would come back and blister in 8 years later.
And part of this, isn't this part of what we're talking about? We talk about the value of affirmative action. People said that when Barack Obama being elected president shows African-American children everywhere that they can be president. And Mayor Lightfoot, I think, said the same sort of thing about black gay woman being elected mayor, that the importance of role models is certainly undeniable.
It's legit.
Of course, it's not the only thing. You can say, well, we'll have a few black doctors and then problem solved. Obviously, that's not the case. And if that's your takeaway from what Buttigieg was saying, then I think you're misunderstanding him. And I feel like the essay in The Root, it acted like he was saying this is the only problem with these black people is they don't have enough role models. If they only had role models, then we'd be fine. That is... here we are, five white people sitting around talking about this.
I know. Well, that's our perspective, and you can't fix that.
But I do feel like he identified part of the problem, and he's getting blistered for not identifying more of the problem, putting it into better context. When he was running for mayor, it was 7 years ago, and it was 8 years
ago. I'll also put on my political reporter hat on top of my white woman hat. I have a lot of hats on all of a sudden. But he's polling at 0% with black people across the country.
This would not have been a story
right.
if that was not
so
the case.
So that's what the issue is. And so, Buttigieg has yet to sort of figure out how to talk to African-American men or African-American women. And that right now is the fundamental problem with his candidacy. And the fact that this is sort of where where he started, maybe inartfully or incompletely expressed, I think reveals that he has a significant gap to close with figuring out how to talk about these issues and how to reach these voters. Because let's be honest, you will not be the next nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States if you can't convince black people to vote for you. That's just the Democrat. That's just how it is. And so I think this is an interesting illustration of how sort of things have changed also in 8 years. Because while in 8 years ago, it might have been enough to say we need more role models, I think after the Obama presidency and all of sort of the aftermath of it, I think that at least I feel more aware of the limitations of what just role modeling can do. And I think that's part of it, too.
John O'Caldwell, who is, I don't know, do you guys who John O'Caldwell is? He wrote a book. He's from the south side of Chicago, one of 9 or 10 kids. His mom was a crack addict. She's still alive today. But anyway, he rose up to eventually get a degree at Chicago State. And now he's on Fox News on occasion as commentator. He's a young black man. He's got a book out. He was in our studio. He said just what you said, Heather. You are not going to win this thing if you don't marshal more minority votes. And Mayor Pete cannot. You know, Steve Bertrand, were he here, would say Mayor Pete's biggest obstacle is his orientation, but I'm hearing that that might not be it.
I don't believe it is. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that
that doesn't play well with
his community is less
either.
More anti-gay or not.
The brief against him in the black community had to do or has to do with his dealings with a police shooting,
right?
In South Bend.
And the dealings with the police chief, which was all part of that.
Right. And the thing about African American voters, I've heard this said, is that they are not. They are smart voters, and they will vote their interest. And in the law, if it comes down to a choice between Pete Buttigieg and Donald Trump, they'll vote for Pete Buttigieg. But in the primary, when he reaches South Carolina, where I think more than half the Democratic electorate is African American, and you're polling at 0%. You're not going to win. He may well win Iowa. The polls I've seen have shown him he's doing well in Iowa, and now he's doing well in New Hampshire. He may win both of those because Elizabeth Warren seems to be slipping, and Joe Biden is just kind of he's treading water. He's still doing well, but you could easily come out of these first three primaries, which usually feel fairly decisive or narrow the field down quite a bit. You might have
you know who the players are.
You might have room for like a Bloomberg coming in at that point.
So I think Bloomberg is actually polling lower with African Americans than Pete Buttigieg.
Stop and frisk.
Well, remember the Saturday
Patrick, then?
Remember the Saturday Night Live bit where Mayor Pete just says, "Why am I not winning this thing?" You know, because of all of the craziness, and he's the one that makes sense. I think that the Trump attack on the Bidens is having some sort of net effect, don't you guys?
There's one question in my mind first, and that is which Democratic candidate has the plurality of the black vote? Because one thing that I saw this week was two new polls on Trump's approval among black voters, and it was a lot higher than you would expect. It was like over 25%. The polling that did that didn't seem to be the most reputable polling.
I was going to say, I don't believe those polls.
But I was looking at previous polling of Trump approval among, you know, 5 or 6 other polls, and there was some that were in double digits, and that was curious to me. That's not something I would have expected.
Yeah.
But who among Democrats is sort of winning the black vote right now?
I think it's candidates? Biden right now,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's what I expect. So if we're talking about, you know, Mayor Pete's record in South Bend leading to a lack of black support, how is that not affecting Biden? I mean, he's the architect of all the, you know, tough on crime stuff. He doesn't have the best record.
Vice president.
That's it, right? That's all it'll take.
Okay. I got to tell you, when the president said, "I don't know why Rudy Giuliani went over to Ukraine," you'll have to ask Rudy why he was over there. And Rudy had previously said, "I went over there to do the president's bidding," but now the two of them seem to be distancing themselves.
Did you hear
themselves.
The bus thumping over Rudy Giuliani?
He's got an insurance, but Giuliani says he's got an insurance policy.
You know, the one thing that jumps out at me about all this stuff is that there are all these people who are close to the president, Mike Pompeo, chief of staff,
Mulvaney,
Bolton, all these people who are Giuliani, all these people who are very close to the president, who'd be able to testify firsthand as to what was going on exactly in those conversations. And they're the people who could exonerate Trump if they testified, ostensibly. But he doesn't want any of them to testify.
He said that he would, and then Well, maybe I'd give you written answers to your questions.
To me, the most telling thing that is difficult for anyone who's going to support Trump to deal with is the fact that there are all these people who he does not want to talk, who know what happened here. And I think we all actually do now know what happened here. And we just don't have the one person saying, yeah, he said to me, don't give money to those people until they run the investigation. Everyone around him knows this is the case, but there's no one. And as long as you don't have that firsthand account of someone saying, you know, yes, we're going to do this, then there's not enough evidence for Republicans to change sides.
So here's the thing. We saw Mick Mulvaney, I saw it with my own two eyes, saying, yes, there was a quid pro quo, get over it. That's what he said.
He took that back the next day.
Where I come from, if the mayor said something yesterday and then called me today and say I take that back, I would say I appreciate your feedback, Mayor Lightfoot. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Like the $50 million to the pastors.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't really work that way. So I think we know what happened. I think that if, you know, John Bolton were to show up or Mulvaney were to show up and say, yep, the president ordered this money stopped, the Republicans have consistently moved the goalposts down the field, and I have no doubt that they would come up with some way to say, well, actually, it's not that bad.
I have 60 seconds. 60 seconds left. The impeachometer. Give me a number. Not that he'll get convicted, but that the House will in fact impeach him. Where are you?
65.
How about you?
I'm at 100%.
Really? How about you?
Oh, yeah, 105%. Yes.
You're looking around like, how is that even a question?
Yeah, sorry.
I'm at 97 just because I think there might be some fingers to the wind right toward the end, and they might say, you know what, let's do a censure. And because we're just going to run into a buzzsaw in the Senate, and Trump will declare victory, and there's nothing good that's going to come of it there. So there's that chance. I think it's a small chance.
I'm 87%, but I'm always wrong about things like this. Eric, Lisa, Heather, Austin, thanks for coming in.
Happy Thanksgiving, Johnny.
Happy
anniversary to you, too.
Happy anniversary, Brenda.
Brenda, that's nice of you to say. We're produced by Aleph Garris. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.